to Saraswati Thakur on his appearance day. I will just mention that on this day, 45 years ago on this day, I was with Prabhupada in Mayapur, and I celebrated this day with him. Yeah, I'm just gonna... There, can you hear? So Prabhupada, on this day, I remember he had a cushion placed on the floor, and he sat on that, and he put his guru's picture on the Vyasasana, and Prabhupada spoke. So 45 years have gone very quickly, for those who are old enough to know how quickly they've gone. And so now I never imagined but everything that would happen since then, but here we are. So, we'll chant first. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasati Tinamine Namo Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada. Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada, Jaya Prabhupada. So, is there any water in the house? Is that extra? Is that included? Okay. Don't even ask. So, thank you all for coming. I was meditating last night and this morning on Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur. And I was... thinking deeply about his extraordinary qualities. And so I'd like to mention a few things that I thought about and other things. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur plays in history a very pivotal role. As we know, his father, Bhakti Vinod Thakur, revived Lord Chaitanya's movement. There were, of course, Vaishnavas in the world who loved Lord Chaitanya, but there was nothing like a movement. And so Bhaktivinoda Thakur, utilizing his high position within the colonial government and acting as a pure devotee with a very with a great education, he was, even from the point of view of worldly history, he was a leading intellectual of his time. He wrote poetry in three languages, and he was a pure devotee. an extraordinary soul. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, it was to this family, to this father, that by Krishna's arrangement, Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was born. He inherited certainly his father's brilliant intellect. He did not have his father's propensity to, or simply, he did not get married. He remained a Naishika Brahmachari. And it's interesting because he also had, you could say, an intellectual life before he manifested, revealed himself as a great Acharya. He taught Suri Siddhanta, he was a college professor, and then at a certain point he began the mission for which he took birth in this world. And Bhakti Siddhanta, if you look at what he contributed, his father had built up a mission, but in his father's mission, as far as I know, there were not ashramas. There weren't communities of brahmacharis and sannyasis. There wasn't the type of, the type of preaching, Bhakti Siddhanta, really following Lord Chaitanya, going all over India. Lord Chaitanya traveled extensively in his Madhya Leela in the 6 years of his life that he was traveling. Of course, he went to Vrindavan from Bengal, which is really halfway across India. And he traveled around South India. He inspired Tukaram, who preached in West India. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur did not, he was a householder, did not travel like that, but in his own community, he inspired many people, including leading citizens. But it was Bhakti Siddhanta who then manifested sort of the forerunner, direct forerunner of ISKCON, the model where there are ashrams, there are brahmacharis, sannyasis, and of course grihastas, and there is aggressive, not in the bad sense of the word, there is vigorous traveling and preaching, opening up centers in many different cities, and of course Bhaktivinoda Thakur sent one of his books to the West, and there are many powerful statements from Bhaktivinoda Thakur about the need to preach in the West. So preaching in the Western countries effectively, powerfully, and actually establishing Krishna consciousness in its pure form in the Western countries, Bhaktivinoda Thakur is the first one that really directly articulated this. Of course, ultimately it goes back to Lord Chaitanya, that Prithivite Ache Jata Nagaradi Gram, in all the towns and villages of the world. Prithivi means literally in Sanskrit means the wide earth. It's a name, comes from the word Prithu. It's actually the feminine, you know the word Prithu. The great avatar, Prithu, also in Sanskrit, means very wide and broad. And Prithu actually cultivated and reorganized the earth. So Prithvi or Prithivi is a feminine, and it means something like the wide earth. And so Lord Chaitanya first gave this vision. Of course, you could trace it back to Krishna. Lord Krishna said that in the Bhagavad Gita, Bhoktaram Yagyas Tapasam, I'm the enjoyer of sacrifice and austerity. Sarva Loka Maheshram, the Lord of all the worlds, not just the Lord of India. And Suhridam Sarva Bhutanam, the well-wishing friend of every creature. And the word well-wishing is Suhrit, which literally means good heart. Hrit is English heart. And Su means good. So Krishna is good-hearted toward everyone. He's the well-wishing friend of everyone. So Lord Krishna, in many places in the Gita, declares that he is the Lord, Sarvasya Chaham Hridisandivishna. I am in the heart of every living being. Ishwara Sarva Bhutanam. I am the Lord of all creatures. And so it was Lord Chaitanya, who's of course the same person, Krishna, who in the same spirit as the Lord of all creatures, Krishna says in the Gita, Pitaham Asya Jagato, I am the father of this universe. Mata, and the mother. Dhata, the creator. Pitamaha, The father, the grandfather. Actually, in Sanskrit, you say father grand. Pitamaha. So this is a clear message of Krishna. Lord Chaitanya, who's Krishna himself, then says that my intention is to spread my mission, my glories, all over the earth, all over the wide earth. And then it was Bhaktivinoda Thakur, among the great acharyas, who actually articulated this in a modern language, in a modern context, and took the first step. I mean, the mere fact that Bhaktivinoda Thakur preached in English, wrote books in English, he mastered all the intellectual currents of his day, and he was a leading intellectual, he was totally up to date, he knew what all the great thinkers were saying. And then Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, that's my point, was born into all of this. And so it's very interesting to see that given Krishna's statement about the universality of his lordship, of his concern for all living beings, given how Lord Chaitanya then expressed this. And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur translated all of this, enacted all of this in the modern world, and this is what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur inherited. And Bhaktisiddhanta was very much attuned to this. In fact, it's what he was thinking about constantly, this inheritance and his role in not only preserving but extending, applying, expanding this glorious inheritance. In the material world, people are, you know, they like to be proud of their families, especially if your dad's not in jail and you're, you know, and your mother's kind of decent. So, but people liked it, you know, like for example, in Europe in the old days, the lords, the great persons would have, of course, great estates, and they would have galleries. They were called galleries where they would have paintings, no photographs, and they would have galleries of all their forefathers and the great ladies, and so that would be typical in every house of every respectable person. They would show their lineage. And so our spiritual lineage is beyond compare. No one in the world can point to such a glorious, distinguished, learned, pure, powerful lineage as the Gaudiya Vaishnavas. And so Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is a central key figure in this. And of course he sent some of his disciples to England, to London. The results were a little, you know, they tried and they achieved something, but ultimately a little underwhelming. He called them back. And then of course our Prabhupada, inspired by his guru, keenly aware of not only the example of his guru, but also his direct instruction. It's very famous that when Prabhupada first met Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur and saw that Abhay Charandey was a learned young person, was learned, fluent in English, college educated, which was actually a small minority of Indians at the time. The percentage of Indians under the Raj, the British colony, who actually had a college education, it was a very small number. And at that time, we should all, I mean, now if you think of Calcutta, you don't think of the most organized, well-kept city on earth, I have to say, although it's, you know, it has its glories. But actually, for a long time, Calcutta was the capital of the Raj. It was the intellectual center of India. And it was in this intellectual center that Lord Chaitanya's movement revived and began to flourish. And so Prabhupada, he inherited this from ecstatic cries. He inherited this from Bhaktisiddhanta, this And he preached in English. I mean, when Prabhupada was, after Prabhupada started ISKCON, he'd be in India, and he'd be giving lectures when there were, where there were hundreds or thousands of Indians, many of whom didn't speak English, and there would be maybe, you know, a dozen or two of his disciples, and Prabhupada would give his lectures in English. So Prabhupada definitely inherited, because Prabhupada also, as a liberated soul, inherited from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur the determination, the understanding of what Lord Chaitanya really wanted. And so I always think on these days, I mean, we can, of course, tell many anecdotes and stories and, you know, nectar and all that. And we, of course, we should always preserve that and relish that. But to me, the real point of these days is how to serve these great souls. Not simply to regale ourselves with anecdotes, but how do we actually serve them? How do we understand, just as Prabhupada gave that perfect example of how you respond to the mercy of your spiritual master. Occasionally, Prabhupada would tell stories. I mean, he would, you know, there were a few stories he would tell about his guru. But, you know, 99.9% of Prabhupada's response to his guru, Prabhupada's way of glorifying his guru, was not anecdotes. It was serving his guru, carrying out, expanding the mission of his guru, understanding perfectly and intimately what his guru wanted and doing it. That's the way that Prabhupada, for the most part, glorified, honored, and remembered his spiritual master. So it seems to me that the most important, and of course we should talk about Bhaktisiddhanta, we should remember his life, his example, but it seems to me that the most important way to glorify him, to honor him, is to rededicate ourselves to his mission, which of course Prabhupada, our Prabhupada, in a historically unique and incredible way, Prabhupada took his guru's mission. He had to, sometimes people say, well, Prabhupada left the Gaudiya Math. Prabhupada didn't leave the Gaudiya Math. There was no Gaudiya Math. I mean, there were different branches here and there with the name Gaudiya Math. But Bhaktisiddhanta's united pan-Indian movement no longer existed. It had disintegrated, and Prabhupada explains exactly why that happened. Prabhupada was very clear about why that happened. The failure to follow Bhaktisiddhanta's order to form a governing body and so on. And that's why Prabhupada took so much care to prevent history from repeating. So Prabhupada, in establishing ISKCON, in establishing a very clear and solid administrative foundation, and in imbibing perfectly the spirit of Bhaktisiddhanta, that was the best service. That's how Prabhupada glorified his guru. That's how Prabhupada glorified his guru, by dedicating himself, heart and soul, giving his life to make his guru's mission a success. And so on this day, and every day, but especially today, I believe that's what we should do. That each of us should rededicate ourselves and really, to use Prabhupada's expression, tax our brains to see how we can do more without obviously driving ourselves to nervous or physical exhaustion. I mean, you know, we're actually adults now. In the old days, we were very enthusiastic, but we weren't the most mature creatures on earth. And so, you know, we have to take care of ourselves. We obviously have to keep ourselves healthy, physically, mentally, intellectually, and of course, ultimately, spiritually. But within a healthy, balanced life, each of us, I mean, and somehow or other, here we are in the Western countries. Here we are. And Of course, I wanted to mention, and this is really central to our lives, and that is that when Prabhupada first met his guru told him that he should preach, you know, to in the West or in English. And Prabhupada took that as everything. Even though he was a householder, he had children, and he couldn't immediately do what he later did. But he was always thinking about that. He was always thinking about Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's instruction. And the fact that Bhaktisiddhanta, although at that time he didn't really have a successful mission in the Western world, and he had a very successful mission in India, because preaching Krishna consciousness in India is like preaching Christianity in America. If you're a charismatic preacher or a good preacher and you're, you know, serious and all that, and you go out and you preach Christianity, you're going to get lots of followers. You know, you can develop a mega church or something. But so even though things weren't really happening in the West, Bhaktisiddhanta sent people to the West, but still he gave Prabhupada that order. He gave Prabhupada that order, and Prabhupada enshrined Bhaktisiddhanta's order to him. He enshrined that order in his pranam mantra. So that every day, every one of Prabhupada's disciples and followers, because, you know, it doesn't matter where you are in the pecking order. It's not that if I was initiated by Prabhupada, therefore somehow I have some secret or I have a unique relationship. Whoever dedicates himself to Prabhupada the most has the most intimate relationship. I've explained this many times. If it were the fact that if by being Prabhupada's direct disciple, you automatically have a stronger relationship with Prabhupada, that would lead to an absurd conclusion. Because if that were the case, then in Prabhupada's mission, every succeeding generation would have a weaker and weaker connection with Prabhupada. Which is absurd, because, so as I often explain, Prabhupada actually had two positions in his mission, two explicit positions. One position was as a Diksha Guru. Another position, which was actually more important, and which Prabhupada considered more important, was that he was the founder Acharya of ISKCON. So on all of his books, Prabhupada didn't put his name and then Diksha Guru of ISKCON. On all of his books, he had his name put, and actually when this wasn't put, he threw people out of the movement, his own disciples, for taking that title off. You know, his name, and then founder Acharya of ISKCON. When Prabhupada introduced himself to leading people, like whether political leaders or whoever, cultural leaders, he didn't say, I am A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, I am the Diksha Guru of ISKCON. He presented himself as the founder Acharya of ISKCON. And no matter who your guru is, Prabhupada is equally our founder Acharya. Prabhupada is not my founder Acharya more than he's the founder Acharya of my disciples. And so in Prabhupada's most important role, of course, Prabhupada's disciples should be obviously, you know, just let them cut in line when there's a prasadam line, you know, and things like that. I mean, I appreciate all the little perks, but in the most important sense, in terms of the purpose of your life, in terms of at the end of your life, how valuable was your life to Prabhupada? In terms of being empowered, receiving direct empowerment from Krishna, from Lord Chaitanya, through the parampara, through Prabhupada, whoever your guru is, you have the same access, you have the same power of relationship with the parampara if you actually dedicate yourself. So therefore, anyone with any bona fide ISKCON guru can become the most powerful preacher. And it's open for everyone. It's open for everyone. Prabhupada, I'll just quote one little anecdote because it is philosophical. It's not just cute. And that is, one time we were walking with Prabhupada in Rancho Park in Los Angeles, which was my neighborhood park when I was growing up. I would walk with Prabhupada over the baseball fields where I used to play, past the tennis courts where I used to play. It was kind of, I don't want to say cognitive dissonance, but it was definitely two worlds coming together. And so we were walking with Prabhupada there, and one time, I remember very clearly, I can just see it, as if it's happening, what is happening now, and Prabhupada stopped. When he wanted to make a point, a really important point, sometimes he would stop in his walk and put his cane down. Ambarish, I'm sure you remember that. So he was really pleading with us to take his mission seriously. And you may think, you know, because Prabhupada gets all this worship, and you may think that, yeah, back in those days, if Prabhupada said jump, everyone said how high. But the fact is that despite the fact that we, as immature young devotees, thought that we were surrendered to Prabhupada, actually, in retrospect, Prabhupada sometimes really, you know, it was hard for him to get us to do certain things. Like, for example, Prabhupada struggled unsuccessfully, actually, to get all of his disciples, or most of them, to read his books. And Prabhupada, I remember he joked one time sarcastically in a class in L.A. He said, you should read these books. So he said that you're selling my books, which I appreciate. But so if someone asks you, sir, you're selling these books, do you also read them? Then you can tell them, no, I don't read the books, I only sell them. And if you consider just, you know, a little tough love here, Prabhupada had thousands and thousands of disciples. How many of them who are alive are actively engaged in spreading his mission? Which is connected to the fact that a lot of people didn't read his books and didn't really have that powerful connection based on Vani. So in any case, Prabhupada stopped in his walk and he quoted the verse from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 11, where Krishna says, Mayaivaite nihata purvam evam. Literally, by me alone, all of these soldiers have already been killed. Nimitta matram bhava, become just the instrument, Savyasacha. So Prabhupada said that he actually took the part of Krishna. He was kind of like speaking. You like Krishna Arjuna talking, Prabhupada speaking both parts. And so he said, Arjuna, do not think that these soldiers are going home again. They're not going back home. They're going to die here. I've already slain them. Now you take the credit. And if you don't take the credit, I will give it to someone else. And Prabhupada said, he turned to us and he was pleading again, because you have to understand that Prabhupada couldn't get everyone to do everything he wanted, even though everyone was jumping up and down and bowing at his feet. And so Prabhupada said, why don't you become Krishna's instrument? Krishna is offering this to you. Krishna has already spread his Sankirtan movement all over the world, but he will give you the credit. Why don't you take the credit? If you don't take it, someone else will get it, but why don't you take it? And so if there's anything to remember about Bhaktisiddhanta, it's that he dedicated his life to serving the mission of his father, and you could say, you know, his father and great inspiration, Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And Prabhupada was inspired by this. Prabhupada, more than anyone else in the world, took seriously, he took completely to heart the desire of his spiritual master. And he dedicated his life to it. So now, if you look around, you'll find that the Hare Krishna movement in the West, despite the fact there are many excellent devotees. There are many great souls, there are many excellent devotees, there are many excellent programs. Here, for example, I think Akuti, my god sister Akuti, I've been told is responsible for that amazing Echo Farm, or whatever you call it, which is an extraordinary accomplishment. There are great schools here. This community itself is it's an extraordinary community, so many great souls. So it's not a question of blaming someone, it's not a question of pointing out that, you know, this person or that person. It's that somehow or other, together, we have to expand Prabhupada's Western mission. That's what Bhakti Siddhanta told Prabhupada. We approach Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur through Prabhupada. That's called parampara, the ascending process. So therefore, we approach Bhakti Siddhanta, or we serve Bhakti Siddhanta, by serving Prabhupada, who is serving Bhakti Siddhanta. And so we have to serve Bhakti Siddhanta's direct order to our Prabhupada, which defined Prabhupada's life, his mission. So that's the way we serve Bhakti Siddhanta, by serving his mission as revealed and expanded by Srila Prabhupada. So this is a day for me to rededicate myself, to find within myself even more determination. It's like if you're in football game, volleyball game, it's very unlikely that most of you will find yourself in such a game in your future, but if you remember, I mean, I used to play sports, and when you're in a game, let's say you're losing or you're not winning, and you're tired, you're exhausted, somehow you find within yourself that extra strength, that energy, and you go out and you win the game. It takes something like that. All of us are doing our best in our own way. Everyone's different. Everyone has different abilities, different limitations. Everyone has a different state of health. Some people, we have different social situations. We have families, or we have disciples to take care of. You know, everyone has their life. But the point is that whatever life we have to find something extra inside to somehow rebuild the Western mission on the scale that Prabhupada had it, and even go beyond that. So that's the way I believe, ultimately, we glorify Bhakti Siddhanta. Of course, we should bow down, we should offer flowers, chant mantras. I mean, we would be offensive if we didn't do those things. But we do those things in order to create within ourselves the proper consciousness that will inspire us to go out and do something. That's why we bow down. That's why we offer the flowers. It's to somehow or other create within ourselves the proper consciousness to go out and do what we have to do for the great acharyas. So, thank you very much. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to take a shot at answering them. Ambarish Prabhu. My dear old friend.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you very much for the very inspiring class. I really needed to hear it. I've had some experience traveling around the world trying to raise awareness and raise funds for the TOVP. And many, many devotees from all over the place have been very enthusiastic. But I've had a hard time with some of the leaders because they have their own program of carrying out what they see is the mission that Srila Prabhupada gave to them. And that's a lot different than getting involved with the TOVP or whatever. Now, many of the leaders have been very enthusiastic and have jumped on board and have really helped us a lot. But it's difficult in some places, and I won't mention any places, but it's been very difficult to get some of the leaders to get involved because they feel like their mission is important and they have to do it for their disciples, you know. So I wanted to ask you your thoughts on how we get ourselves back on track as a movement and push towards one mission, which is Srila Prabhupada's mission. How do we create that togetherness?
Thank you. I guess the way my thinking works, I immediately try to understand what's the root cause of this. Because the behavior, of course, you know very well. But where is this really coming from? And so I will take advantage of your question, not to say something else, but to make a point that is very important to me. And that is, I am convinced that there is something wonderful, just ecstatic, magical, that Prabhupada created in us, in ISKCON, which is very much weaker now than it was when Prabhupada was here. And for me, it was like, and I think that ingredient, that element, which has, I think, is very, very weakened, is sort of the answer to your question. So when Prabhupada was here, ISKCON, of course, was smaller, and you could say sociologically that's a factor, but it was very much a super united movement with extraordinary solidarity. And this manifested in practical ways. For example, if someone, some devotee, anywhere was successful in preaching or found some way to get through, everyone wanted to incorporate that. And Prabhupada, as soon as Prabhupada saw something was working somewhere, he said, explain this to all the temples. This should be done in all of our temples. And so, I mean, there was intense competition. There was intense competition. When my Latin American zone, it was the first to ever defeat Radha Damodar Sankirtan Party in a December marathon. And I don't think it's because we cheated. I mean, I think we actually did win. I mean, I didn't have absolute control of all the counting the different countries. But anyway, so by Krishna's arrangement, in January, soon after the marathon, Prabhupada came to Los Angeles, and I flew there to meet him, and Tamal Krishna Goswami also flew there to meet him. And so we were walking with Prabhupada in the Palisades Park in Santa Monica, and Prabhupada, he was kind of teasing Tamal, because he was, I mean, I forget his exact words, but sort of in American English, he was really saying something like, hey, so, you know, Latin America, they beat you. Are you going to take that? What are you going to do about it? I mean, that's really what he was saying in his own, you know, Indian English. And so Tamal and I were, you know, we were laughing. And then, and of course, Prabhupada saw that the competition was, you know, it's Krishna conscious. And then I remember Prabhupada stopped, and I'll never forget this. He simply said, I like this competition. But even though Prabhupada said that, but the competition was because, okay, Radha Damodar is, you know, doing this, we're all working together. And so that solidarity was there, so that the TOVP, we all know that it's, you know, Prabhupada took this very seriously. He very much wanted this. He wanted this as to carry out the vision of the previous acharyas and his own vision. And so there was a time when ISKCON had the power to mobilize, to unite, and to do amazing things by getting behind key projects. I mean, as Ambarish Prabhu said, I mean, of course, every leader does have to take their own project very seriously. But at the same time, they're international projects. We sold books. I sold a lot of books. I actually won a few marathons in Latin America when I was slightly younger. I mean, it was really, you can't tell the difference, but I'm a little older now. So we were selling books, and we knew that the books we were selling those sales were producing large income, and the Prabhupada was spending this money to build Mayapur, to build Vrindavan, and we were happy to do that. We were happy to do that. So in a sense, what Ambarish Prabhu is calling for, what he, you know, what is needed, is that spirit. Prabhupada saw that India is the spiritual center. This is coming from the Krishna West deviant. I mean, Prabhupada, even in my deviancy, I have some common sense. And so, Prabhupada knew that, I'll tell you a story actually about India, about Mayapur, since Ambarish's project, of course, is in Mayapur. In 1976, I was Prabhupada's secretary. Actually, I came to be a secretary. He never gave me one secretarial job. He just liked me to come, and, you know, he wanted to tell me things, and so I would kind of, you know, in a respectful sense, hang out with Prabhupada. So one time, it was actually, I think it was Gaur Purnima Day, which is coming, it's Gaur Purnima Day, and I was on the balcony, and those days we only had the Lotus Building, and then while I was there, Prabhupada was actually personally overseeing the construction of what we called the Long Building. And so Prabhupada, I was on the balcony chanting, Prabhupada came out on the balcony in the evening, and I was watching. I'd never seen so many human beings in one place in my life. Because hundreds of thousands of people were coming into, you know, streaming into our property to go take darshan and Gaur Purnima. I mean, even at an LA Rams game as a kid, you know, I never saw that many people. And so I was astonished. I'd never seen that much humanity. And they were all coming to see Lord Chaitanya. And so when Prabhupada came on the balcony, I was inspired, and I walked over to Prabhupada and offered obeisance, and I said, Prabhupada, India is amazing. And Prabhupada kind of looked at me as if I'd committed the fault of damnation by faint praise. And so Prabhupada looked at me and said, it is the most important place in the universe. So again, what Ambarish Prabhu is calling for is a return to Prabhupada's system. I mean, there's many ways in which we have to return. There's a lot of things we have to return to, frankly. But to be able to act as a single society, as a united society. And of course, India is the spiritual anchor of the movement. I'm, you know, obviously totally into Western preaching. I want to build a lot of Western anchors also. But Vrindavan, I mean, I can say that for all of my rabble-rousing, for Western preaching, I can say that my most powerful Krishna conscious experiences took place in Vrindavan, in Mayapur, and also in the West, but I've had extraordinary experiences in the holy places. And so I know that it's a spiritual world. I personally know that these places are the spiritual world. And so so that, I guess that would be my reply to you. I think that ISKCON has to revive that precious, essential understanding that we had when Prabhupada was here. That we are one society. Because if you think about it, if I can be, you know, we're all adults here and we can talk frankly, I hope. So I'll be frank here perhaps during the last time I'm invited to give a class here, but Prabhupada always explained, and the Bhagavatam explained, that there's, you know, the Kanishta Adhikari. Kanishta, by the way, means lowest in Sanskrit, literally, and Madhyam Adhikari and Uttam Adhikari. And the Bhagavatam says that the lowest, that the Prakriti Bhakta, a devotee on the material platform, is one who is sort of, you could say, totally puja-centric. Archayam eva. Only in archa, only in, and of course, that's Krishna there, and we all know that it's Krishna, and I'm not saying that we should in any way neglect deity worship. That's not my point. We come to the temple to get inspiration to see Krishna, because we can see God here, and the whole point is to walk out the door and keep seeing Krishna in everyone's heart. This is sadhana, Krishna darshana. And that's what the Bhagavatam says. Archayam eva haraye pujang jakshadhaye hite. Literally, one who undertakes worship of the Lord, only in the... Oh my God. Do I have to go back to play? Only in the deity form. And you don't worship the deity in the hearts of all living beings. In other words, where is Krishna? Oh, he's in the temple. I mean, of course he's in the temple. But every living body is a temple. Every living body is a temple. The deity, this deity, is in the heart of every living being. And we are practicing here so we can see this deity in the hearts of all living beings and in the hearts of other devotees. I mentioned this in reply to Ambarish because if we have temples that are simply puja-centric, I mean, obviously the deity is the deity. But when I say puja-centric, what I mean is if I go and see the deities, that's my spiritual life. As opposed to, of course, coming to see the deities, taking that inspiration that I've seen God. I go to the temple and I see God face to face. And with that inspiration, I go out to save, to serve all living beings, to be Krishna's instrument to save them, because the deity I worship is in their hearts. And so in a movement where this is an end in itself, if I come to see the deities, that's my spiritual life. That's called, well, the Bhagavatam says very strong things about that, material platform. And so in a movement, if we have temples, or lots of temples, where it's kind of like that, my religious life as I go and see the deities, and I don't lose sleep at night thinking how to save all living beings because the deity is in their heart. If that's not keeping me up at night, if I don't wake up every day and worry about that, then every community is totally self-centered. Because if we have temples, if we have communities where people are not losing sleep at night, not constantly discussing among themselves, worrying, acting, how do we save this planet? How do we establish this movement? How do we make Prabhupada's ISKCON a powerful, relevant spiritual force in America, in Europe? Then when someone comes around and asks you for money for some other deity, what's that got to do with me? We've got our deity. And it's not about saving the world, it's about spending more and more money on our deity. And so, to be frank, I think that's my analysis as a historian, as a sort of an irrepressible nuisance in the Hare Krishna movement. I think that because Prabhupada, despite our own obvious limitations, Prabhupada lifted the whole movement to the Madhyam platform. So that even if you were a cook or a pujari, you were cooking to feed Krishna's warriors. If you were a pujari, you were making, dressing the deities beautifully, pleasing the deities so they would smile, so that Prabhupada's preachers could come and be inspired and energized to go out again and try to save the world. Everything, Prabhupada said it, our temples are like military bases from which we go out to throw the bombs of these books and all kinds of preaching. And that the deities have to be served beautifully because it's the deity who is inspiring and empowering the preaching. When the deity is pleased by our devotion, by our worship, then the deity enlightens us, empowers us to go out and carry out Lord Chaitanya's mission. So this was always my understanding of deity worship. And if our ISKCON temples have that spirit, then of course, when you come around or one of your agents, And you remind everyone that this is the way Prabhupada did things. We were all preaching, we were all developing our local centers, but there was a central ISKCON bank, which in those days was the BBT, and that Prabhupada was certainly encouraging and even financing the construction of temples in the West, and traveling, frankly, risking his own health and ultimately giving his life to travel when he didn't have the strength to travel, to encourage the Western preaching. So he gave everything to develop Western preaching, but he took a part of that to construct a super powerful mission in Bharat Varsha. And so if we can just remember, but again, you see, it's like, you know, it's the horse and carriage, they go together. You know what they say, that old song, Love and Marriage? They go together like a horse and carriage, you can't have one without the other. So, yeah, exactly. Love those old songs. Anyway, it's a song about chastity. You can't have love without marriage. So, if we can somehow get the Western mission back into Prabhupada's preaching mood, then of course people will say yes when you ask them to, you know, help us keep alive Prabhupada's system and Prabhupada's wishes. And we all build up our local places and we all build up Prabhupada's special projects. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you so much. I don't know if I'll be able to phrase it as a proper question, but I want to put forward just some ideas and have you respond. But somehow or another, I was thinking about Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati's appearance day coming, and I actually took my dictionary and looked up absolute, sentient, you know, from Prabhupada's prayer to him that he so appreciated. And and like night before last, I think it was, I listened to an interview with Urmila, who was speaking about decentralization in relation to the ISKCON movement. And so what came together in my mind was, but I know she's a loyal Prabhupada follower and ISKCON person, and yet she was pointing out quite forcefully some tendency towards like managing from the top down. So I think it, my topic that I hope you can address is the difference between like say micromanaging or giving orders and inspiring each of us to act from our own individual initiative, which is in relation to Krishna, that sentient, perceiving, feeling right. Entity.
Thank you. Very interesting, important socio-historical question. Okay, first of all, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that we have to be moderate, really, in all of our human activities. He gives some examples. He says, don't eat too much or too little, don't sleep too much or too little. And then he says, really in all activities. So, if you study the political history of the world, and this is political, because I don't mean political in the pejorative sense, like you're just being political, like you're a, you know, like a selfish, conniving person who's acting for political motives. I'm using political in a more academic sense, involving the exercise of authority and power. And so when you get a bunch of human beings together who form a society, that creates power. Because inevitably, you know, anarchy is neurologically impossible. And so there is power and authority when you have a bunch of people following some common principles or lead. And so who exercises it? Who wields that power? That's a question of political science. And so what I think what history shows us, and this corresponds perfectly to Prabhupada's own instructions, if you look at all of them, is that you can't go to either extreme. Like Krishna says, we have to be moderate. So if you just, if you weaken too much the center, and you have this type of centrifugal force going away from the center, history tells us what you get. Eventually you get a bunch of warlords, you know, whether they're, you know, guru warlords, or, you know, Grihastha managing warlords, and the center is weak, and that's what a confederation is. You know, we used to say ISKCON is a confederation. It's actually not. It's a federation. And the difference between a confederation and a federation is, in a confederation, the authority is all in the, out in the hinterland. It's all in the different regions. So that all the, and then all the different regional powers, they give authority to the center. And the center has power only as it is approved and given by the regional members. America is a federation. And actually this, by the way, this very point that Romila brought up was probably the central debate in the Federalist Papers. You know, before the US Constitution was written, there were these debates among very, very smart, learned people about should America be a confederation or a federation? Because they said, we don't want another England. You know, why recreate England with a corrupt king and all that? And so there were people arguing for state power, that, you know, the states have the power, and the states empower a central government which has no power except that awarded to it by the states, and the states can withdraw that power. And the Civil War, I mean, apart from the obvious slavery issue, ultimately the philosophical issue in the Civil War in America was whether America really should have been or should be a confederation or federation. That was really the philosophical issue. And so in ISKCON, if you weaken the center too much, like I said, you can just get, you know, guru, sannyasi, or managerial warlords. And ISKCON ultimately, and societies like that tend to dissolve. You know, the aggregate, the total society is unstable, it comes unglued regularly in history. So that's what history shows. And that's not obviously not what Prabhupada wanted, and we know that's not what Prabhupada wanted because he said so in the very first line of his last will and testament. He said the GBC shall be the ultimate managing authority for the entire. So consider these two key adjectives, ultimate and entire. My mother always used to say I would have been a good lawyer. Anyway, she always used to say that to me. So that's the first line in Prabhupada's will. That's the first line in Prabhupada's will. So obviously the first line in Prabhupada's will blows out of the water any idea that Prabhupada wanted, in a serious sense, a confederation. At the same time, there is an extreme on the other side, because federations can lead to tyranny. Central power can become tyrannical. And that also destabilizes and ultimately destroys societies. Plato points this out. He said tyranny, I mean, Plato talks, he didn't use the word, but about historical dialectics. You know, thesis, antithesis, and then, so Hegel, of course, talked about the historical dialectic. Plato says that political extremes create their opposite, so that tyranny leads to anarchy, or anarchy leads to tyranny, as it did in Germany after World War I. Anarchy